When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Today's episode of Canada Land Shortcuts is brought to you by Hover.com. If you have your domain with somebody else, now is the time to transfer it to Hover, who are better, because you'll get a 40% discount off of the next year of your domain registration. Go to hover.com/transfermydomain right now. Katie Toth, Halifax-based freelance journalist. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. People can find you in Vice, the Halifax Examiner, and right here on Canada Land, and you used to report for the Village Voice. We are going to talk today about a struggling Toronto couple's noble quest to convert affordable housing into a $2 million flip. And before that, we are going to talk about political coverage in the light of a couple of recent provincial races and this Andrew Scheer thing, and whether or not we have political coverage in this country.
Sheer terror. Sheer curtains.
Excellent. Trademark. This episode of Canada Land Shortcuts is brought to you by Kate Waters, Raleigh Hughes, Ben McDonald, Anne Kavanaugh, Lauren Jane McGlynn, Zoe Maurice, Ashley Redden, and Logan Cooper. Logan, why did you decide to be awesome?
I support Canada Land because Canadian corporate media is seriously ill, and Canada Land might be the only cure we have left.
This episode is also brought to you by Hover.com. Listen, do you have any domain names? Do you have a website that's operational? Do you have any domain names that you're parking for a future project? If you have them and they're not with Hover, then you likely deal with registration once every year or two and then forget about it. And in between, the other domain providers out there hit you up for upgrades, try to sell you other products, try to get you to pay for things like Whois privacy so that people can't figure out your like name, address, and phone number based on your domain that you've registered. It's annoying to work with the other companies. They're often not pleasant companies to deal with. That is what Hover exists as an antidote to. They simply and cleanly and fairly deal with domains and email, and they want your business. They want you to transfer your domain and not wait until a year from now when your domain comes up. They want you to transfer now, and they're offering an incredible incentive for you to do so. If you have domains anywhere, transfer them to Hover right now. You get to keep all of the existing time that you have left on your domain that you paid some other company, and then Hover will add another year to it at a 40% discount. They are making it very cheap and easy to make the right decision and transfer your domains. Go to hover.com/transfermydomain right now. It'll only take a minute and it will save you headaches and likely money in the future.
Good evening. Former Speaker of the House Andrew Scheer pulled off a major political upset tonight, coming from behind.
Andrew Scheer.
Andrew who? Not quite, but there were echoes of Joe who, with a young surprise winner from the prairies. Upset.
Catherine Cullen is on the convention floor. Catherine, this whole evening certainly was a surprise.
So, Katie, who is Andrew Scheer?
When I saw photos of Andrew Scheer up after the story started popping up of him being elected, I thought he was Brad Trost because the photos of them both look so similar. They are literally the same person.
There was this like rush to explain who is this guy who is now, I guess, the most likely candidate to be the next prime minister.
Didn't Toronto Star ask like Andrew who?
Andrew who was their headline. And there were journalists saying like, oh my God, he was the speaker of the House of Commons. Come on, people. But I think that the Star, in trying to reflect what their readers are asking, got the headline right. What I want to know is, did the media fall down in properly vetting the candidates? And I ask this because within hours of him winning and surprising everybody in this race where we were so concerned with O'Leary and Leach and maybe charmed by Michael Chong, I will admit, Andrew Scheer did not even pass my attention. And then Sean Craig, formerly of Canada Land, formerly of the National Post, and his first story with Global News, he has this tweet that Hamish Marshall, Andrew Scheer's campaign manager, is listed as a director of Rebel Media. I felt red to the face because, you know, Canada Land's core competency is not covering politics, though we do have a politics show. We invited all of the conservative candidates onto Commons, but that was before Andrew Scheer announced his candidacy. We completely missed the boat with Scheer, but our core competency is covering media, and we missed that completely. And kudos to Sean Craig for catching it, but he caught it after the guy won.
Right. I mean, in the media's defense, there were a huge number of candidates that were running in this election. And so I think part of it is just this sort of sense of this huge pool. Where do you put your resources? Who's relevant? Who's interesting? And I think Kevin O'Leary and Kelly Leach both played into this kind of exciting narrative that's happening in the U.S. and in France. And I'm not saying exciting in a way that I'm endorsing it, but there does seem to be this shift happening where conservatism is becoming less about religious values and moral values and more about xenophobia and white supremacy, right? And nationalism, if white supremacy is not necessarily part of what Kelly Leach and Kevin O'Leary were espousing, certainly a sort of nationalist idea. And so I think Canada, God knows why, Canadians seem to be really interested, or Canadian media seems to be really interested in seeing if we can match these other global phenomena, these other global stories, when I guess social conservatism still is a relatively big deal here. You know, Andrew Scheer was quiet. He was not as exciting as someone like Brad Trost, which kind of makes sense, which is why he might have managed to pull out the votes of people who found him a decent next choice. So was the media played? Maybe, but I don't know. Like, why would we focus on the most milquetoast people? No disrespect to Andrew Scheer. I'm sure he's a really thrilling guy.
Well, I think you kind of hit it. And I'm not really like, I don't think he played us. Like, I think it would be overly crazy and conspiratorial and paranoid to think that this was some crazy Rebel Media plot.
No.
To slip in a dimpled, smirking face of social conservatism under the radar of these more rabid, polarizing figures. I mean, that's what happened. But I don't think that anyone had that as like as their plot. That would be nutty to think that was the plan. But I think it would also be naive to think that there's no relevance to the fact that Rebel Media has this connection. I mean, there is like a Steve Bannon parallel. And you look at Scheer, and I'm reading about on it now, and it is incorrect to say the media didn't cover him. He was profiled. I don't think he was vetted,
okay,
but he was profiled by all major media. I'm finding out now. And this is more about maybe I was more attracted to these crazy figures, and I ignored this like long read by Althea Raj, which was I think a terrific piece, which I've since read. And so now I know, now that he's the leader of the Conservative Party, now I know that he wants to give parents a $4,000 subsidy to send their kids to private school. Now I know that he has a perfect anti-abortion voting record, that he has voted against extending Human Rights Act to the transgendered, that he wants to withhold funds to universities that limit free speech, by what metric, I don't know. Now I know that he has expressed, it seems, more concern about Islamophobia as it pertains to people who are falsely accused of being Islamophobes, when in fact they're just critical of radical Islam. He's more concerned about that side of Islamophobia than the kind that gets people killed in mosques. He wants to axe the CBC's news division and he has promised to go duck hunting with Faith Goldie. Now I know all of these things. Like, you hit the nail on the head, Katie, because, like, what's the Canadian version of Trump? Oh, it's Kelly Leach. What's the Canadian version of Trump? Oh, it's Kevin O'Leary. And in fact, the Canadian version would be a chubby-cheeked, smirking, pleasant, inoffensive guy who doesn't say crazy polarizing things, but who in fact stands for them.
Right. Or the Canadian version of Trump does not exist, that we still are on the George Bush era.
Yeah. This concern we had with Bernier, because he did a little bit of dog whistling to the Reddit MRAs with the red pill thing. The fact of the matter is that, like, a true libertarian would take no stand on what Canadian values are or on religion. Like, libertarians would not muck around in those things. And the real virulent xenophobic side, yes, Kelly Leach embodied that, but she never really had a chance. I mean, she was a bizarro candidate. This guy was the guy who could create a very big tent that seems to be inclusive of everybody among those nutzos and then beyond.
Right. I mean, when you talk about this idea of trying to find an American story or trying to find our Donald Trump, over here in Nova Scotia, we just had an election where very much a lot of the conversation around the NDP was comparing the leader, Gary Burrell, to Bernie Sanders. And that's the same sort of idea of, like, okay, this major thing has happened in the United States. A rogue democratic socialist has been trying to change the Democratic Party from within. What's our version? And the fact is, respectfully, Mr. Burrell was not a Bernie Sanders for our time. He was not incredibly concise. The NDP picked up a couple of seats, but this was not a charismatic Brooklyn / Vermont Jew taking over the nation with a crazy idea. I don't know why it is that we don't think we're interesting enough and that we need to find parallels with American stories, but it keeps happening.
Yeah, tell me more about the election. I mean, besides trying to fit it into the Bernie Sanders narrative, what played out? And I think one thing that I'm wondering with the conservative race, with Nova Scotia and with BC, is if part of this, like, you've got the one side of it of we're all in the shadow of this American narrative and trying to make our narrative compatible with it or echo it in some way. And on the other hand, we just don't have resources. And I wonder how much of this is just about us not having the resources to adequately cover things and vet candidates.
I mean, when you talk about a lack of resources, Nova Scotia is kind of the perfect example of that, right? Our provincial paper, the staff for our provincial paper, are still on strike. And that means that there is not sort of like a daily paper record with a huge newsroom that has the resources to be going out and picking up those stories. CBC, The Coast, the strike paper Local Express all sort of did work on this, but there is always a loss when you don't have a paper of record that can sort of bring in really strong daily coverage from multiple people every single day. There was a lot of coverage of social media snafus. There was an NDP candidate who was asked to leave because of some social media issues. There was a conservative candidate and there was a liberal candidate, or I guess two conservative candidates. I think one of the things that sort of came to my mind when I kept seeing media coverage about tweets or Facebook posts was that this coverage is easy, right? You are getting the opportunity to say that someone is maybe a bad person or question their character without necessarily having to do loads of interviews, find out about how they run their business, find out about how they work, about their relationships, that kind of thing. And so, to the credit of the public, I don't think many of these social media stories tended to really play. Like, I don't think people tended to get really excited about it. Like, the parties obviously got excited about the opportunity to throw muck at each other. But it just kind of concerns me that we're going to be seeing more and more of these social media stories because they're easy for reporters to write, but they're not necessarily that substantive.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about, like, in BC where this flare-up between Christy Clark and a voter in, like, a variety store or grocery store or something became, like, a hashtag story that got tons of play. And, you know, it's like a forest for the trees thing. And then, like, this nail-biter of an election. And then Global and the Globe and Mail still have stories up saying that Christy Clark won a minority government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course, the NDP and the Greens have just announced a deal. It looks like they're going to form the government. I know Christy Clark is not going to step down, but I feel like I am struggling to just get the information here. Like, are those stories not taken down because there's some aspect to which they are correct or were correct? Or is it, are they just left up because no one's bothered yet? There's just like some basics here that either I'm failing to grasp or it's failing to be communicated. The fact that the CBC built Kevin O'Leary from nothing into this TV bad guy who was in a position to be the front runner, and then he drops out, obviously using the entire process as a promotional tool for his business, which is just about self-promotion. And then the CBC has him back on the air as a commentator on the night of the results of the CBC leadership was baffling to me. And kudos to Tom Harrington of the CBC for saying so, because it's hard to criticize the CBC when you work for the CBC. But those types of stories are arguably much less important than simply knowing who these candidates are.
I mean, I think that the fact is that knowing who candidates are really takes work. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of digging. And in the case of, for example, these Nova Scotia stories around social media, I don't recall ever hearing where these stories came from, if they came from opposition researchers, if they came from the reporters' work themselves. And so that's another factor, is that as reporters become more and more overworked, we're more and more dependent on opposition researchers or on PR people. And so if we're getting stories from those folks, then they're going to be the easy stories that make each other look bad. They're not going to be in-depth character analysis.
That's a terrific point, because the people who have the resources are the interested parties themselves, the parties and those funding them. And you've got all this whole new barrage of shady players or interested party players, lobbyists, sites that are of arguable journalistic mission that are feeding into the news cycle all of the gotchas that they're able to dig up or create. And then we're in a position where, what are we going to do but run it? I mean, it's what people are interested in, and it's a gimme. It's right there for us to take.
I want to throw out there before we, like, just quickly before we switch, that there was, like, some substantial coverage of the Nova Scotia election. You know, one major issue was that Kylie Harris, a communications officer for the Nova Scotia Liberals, who had been a domestic abuser, was hired again, was a communications officer. He was working on this campaign. Media called him out on it, said, what are you doing to the premier, Stephen McNeil? The liberal line was that everyone deserves a second chance, you know? And then shortly after, there was a social media issue where someone wrote a bad tweet and they were asked to leave. And so there is this thing where the parties themselves seem to have decided that social media is even more important than, like, principles or hiring or any of this. Kylie Harris ultimately ended up leaving, but I do think that there is a weird question about what we're prioritizing, not only as members of the media, but as people who consume media and are thinking about how to best play it.
Katie, let's move on to this show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter, like, seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get, like, anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding, like, the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. Duly noted where we note things duly. Can I note something duly?
Please.
It's just the story that everybody should read, and I'm not going to say anything about it except the headline and the byline, because it is the best combination of a headline and byline that I can recall. And here it is from the Vancouver Sun. Murder plot against reporter Kim Bolin revealed at UN gang trial by Kim Bolin.
Oof.
Go read it now. Just like, how perfect is that? I don't mean to make light. I mean, it's obviously it's a hugely traumatic thing to cover your own.
Terrifying.
Yeah, but my God, murder plot against me, story by me. Okay.
Before we duly note onto the next thing, I mean, I think this is a pretty big deal. First of all, the idea of being in a courtroom and hearing your own name being associated with a murder plot from the guys that you report on is terrifying. But I can't help but think about some of the other recent issues of violence against reporters, not to like minimize what Kim Bolin experienced, but like Ben Jacobs, the British Guardian reporter, was just in Montana asking U.S. House of Representatives-elect, who has since won, some questions, ends up getting beaten. Right?
Body slammed.
Body slammed and punched. And Fox News was, people from Fox News was the ones saying, hey, maybe you shouldn't be beating up a reporter. Like, moment of reporter solidarity. And I can't help but think, like, this may happen more and more.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, all of this animosity that is being whipped up against journalists, the minimized role and power of journalists, the increased presence of journalists who don't have the backing of like, oh, you're from the New York Times, who seem like you can fuck with them.
Right.
All of this is adding up to a steady trickle of stories of journalists getting hurt, threatened by law enforcement, by the people they cover. This isn't coincidence that we're seeing more and more of these stories. Absolutely. And by the way, a lot of people said, oh my God, I want to hear this Kim Bolin talk about this on Canada Land. I have asked her onto the show. She's bowing out now. I think that, you know, she's an old school reporter who doesn't want to be the focus of things. And then I'm thinking that the impact on her family and those who care about her, like, I respect and understand that decision, though I definitely would love to talk with her just about covering crime if she's ever interested in that.
I am curious about what sort of role, like, she wrote that the police had warned her that there would be a threat uttered. But what role do police have in terms of protecting journalists? And I mean, I also acknowledge we could be tough cookies to protect. Like, if they had come to her and straight up been like, hey, people have a threat on your life, she might be like, toot, 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 start typing it, right? I don't know. I found maybe it was just a short, tight story and it wasn't a major feature, but I was confused about, like, what role did the police play in terms of making sure that she was safe? And I think those are questions that have still remained unanswered.
Yeah. Look, I want to hear this whole thing from the beginning to the end about this UN gang and cartel links, but maybe Kim will write a book about this one day.
Duly noted. I am currently working on a bit of coverage of two trials that are happening in Nova Scotia right now. Simultaneously, we've got murder trial of Taylor Sampson, who was allegedly killed by William Sandison, a Dalhousie student, was looking forward to med school, and both of them were dealing large amounts of drugs. And this case has just been covered daily, intensely, by colleagues who I really respect at CTV, Global, Metro, just like day-by-day coverage, and Nova Scotians seem really invested. They just don't seem to understand how these two college students could have been embroiled in something so grisly, allegedly. And then down the hall, I've also been looking at a trial of Jimmy Melvin Jr., the second member of a second generation of a known crime and drug family, I guess. The Melvin family is accused of killing Terry Marriott Jr., also second generation. The intergenerational rivalry and beef of these two families has been sort of documented by many media outlets, especially Vice. And it's a lot quieter in that courtroom. You know, there's a lot of family members and people who know the Melvins and the Marriotts. There is another reporter from Local Express and another reporter from CBC, but certainly less intensity in terms of the coverage. And I just sort of found that interesting in terms of whose stories do we value? And like, what is it about sort of like, oh, like these kids were in college that seems to get people's attention? we're talking about crime stories in terms of, you were talking about Vancouver and Kim Bolin. And in general, I think that crime stories sometimes get a bad rap. You talked about this on the last Canada Land. But I think also we don't always talk about which crime stories get attention and why. So I've just been thinking about that a lot lately. I don't have an answer.
That sounds fascinating. We'll throw some links up on the show notes. Duly noted. Katie, I know that you are far from Toronto and that we're not the center of the universe, but every now and then something in the Toronto press might be of interest to people elsewhere. Did you happen to catch this Toronto Life story titled "We Bought a Crack House"?
You mean the modern day Shakespeare piece? You mean the Romeo and Juliet of our times?
Maybe you could try to summarize this piece for our listeners.
All right. This is a story of a family that owned a condo and wanted to upsize, so they fell in love with a house. That house actually was a two-bedroom rat trap, and they had made the mistake of buying that on a whim. I think this is the part people are glossing over. They bought a house, a two-bedroom rat trap, on a whim. It was a mistake. So what they do is they sell the house, move back into the condo, and then they buy a three-bedroom rooming house in Parkdale on a whim again. Like, I mean, fool me once, shame on me, but like, they did this twice. So anyway, this family decides they are going to buy a beautiful old house, the Grand Dame. I'm assuming it's the biggest house on the block, judging by its name, but I could be totally wrong. Completely do a gut reno and kick out the people who are currently living there, who are renting. And their trials and tribulations are many. They completely underestimate the cost of a renovation in a city where renovations are happening all the time. And this is very much a contractor's market. I'm not an expert, but I think that's common knowledge, right? And at some point, we're supposed to feel bad for their outrageous hubris and the fact that they spent 4 years having a really hard time renovating their house because they made a lot of poor decisions. Does that sum it up for you?
I think you got it. Let me try to provide a little of context both before and after the piece. I mean, you talk about Parkdale. This is a Toronto neighborhood that is like what you call a mixed-use neighborhood. All kinds of people live there. It is often pointed to as an example of how
gentrification can work.
It can work. That's right. You're not necessarily pushing people out, that we can all coexist. But there are these beautiful old homes that also, it's a real what's your lens. On the one hand, these rooming houses are one of the last affordable housing options. On the other hand, they are destitute. There's a lot of drug use. There's a lot of crime in Parkdale. The piece itself is this salvo in Toronto Life in the midst of, like, right now, there are violent confrontations on the streets of Parkdale between renters and landlords. There are rent strikes happening in Parkdale right now. There's like the war of Parkdale, and into this heightened atmosphere where people are being kicked out of their homes and dispossessed, and gentrification is starting to not work in Parkdale, comes Toronto Life. Like, the story, it is gobsmacking. The way that Catherine Gion talks about her situation, with just no compassion or insight or self-reflection. She describes herself as, we were cash strapped. We didn't even own a car. They owned three properties. She mentions that, oh yeah, we offloaded our rat trap of a house on somebody else. And then she goes on to just list this litany of stupidities that she, like, hubris is exactly right.
They decide that they want to save money by doing much of the work themselves and picking a cheap contractor. Like, you don't cheap out on a contractor. They don't want to go market rate. So they pick a guy whose best references, the references that he provides them, are, as she puts it, neither glowing nor offensive, or something like that.
This is how she describes the guy. They're looking for contractors, that nothing's cheap enough. And then a man pulled up on his bicycle. He was in his 50s, wore jean cutoffs, a rumpled hat. He was missing a few key teeth and didn't like wearing socks or, as he later informed us, underwear. She then explains that they hired him. And there's parts of it that are like poetry. They're like from an Edward Gorey.
It's beautiful. Like,
the sentence. The bathtub was filled with a mysterious black liquid, the sight of which caused our son, Oliver, to start bawling. And the kicker, I think Ishmael Darrow said this is a beautiful hate read or something. And it is. It's just, you read this thing, you get to the end, and after this, like, these bumbling people who make every mistake with vast sums of money and are taken by opportunists and swindlers while they themselves are trying to exploit, at the end, She says, the last few years have been nerve-wracking, but a renovated semi down the street, once owned by the same couple who sold us our house, just went for $2.1 million. So for now, things look okay. And it's the most beautiful punchline that despite everything, they're going to make a fortune on this house. To provide the context for after the piece came out, it went mega viral and basically is sparking a class war in Toronto right now, at least on Twitter. Like, people are livid over this thing. They are just boiling with rage at Toronto Life. Like how brain dead and context blind can you be? There are a lot of people who are feeling that Toronto Life has just completely misread the temperature. And I want to offer my take on what Toronto Life has done here.
Okay, but before you do, I just want to point out that, yes, is it a little tasteless and a weird middle upper class homeowner aspiration porn about how you too can gentrify a neighborhood? Yes, but I have been a fan of Toronto Life. I started reading Toronto Life mostly for nostalgia purposes when I moved to Halifax for college. And it's never not been like that. You know, like, that was my favorite part, was how out of touch it was. So I do think it's kind of this weird thing of, you're upset that Toronto Life is out of touch now? Like, where have you been?
Why would you assume that I would be upset?
Not you personally, but just...
In response to the outrage, I feel similarly to you. I would go further.
Whoa.
This is a beautiful... This article, I love that... You can read this article in Toronto Life as a wicked piece of satire.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I've written for Toronto Life, and I know how they have, like, there are like a dozen editors worked on this thing. And they polished this piece and made the author of it the most contemptible straw man stand-in for Toronto gentrification. Just like, oh, get these crackheads out of my house, and I sold a rat house to somebody else. And just like, it's, there are sentences in there that I feel like they knew exactly what they were doing. They wound us up beautifully. And in fact, it's almost like a socially progressive piece. I'm going to go there.
Whoa.
Because I feel like, what's Toronto Life going to do? They're going to actually like write like a serious-minded piece about gentrification in Parkdale and the need for affordable. Like, they'll do that. It'll probably be on their website, not in the magazine, and no one will read it. This is beautiful. They're going to take to the streets and burn down Parkdale because of this article. And I think that Toronto Life has done, no, they're not going to do that, and that wouldn't be good. But they've done an incredible service, and they have raised the issue of class in a way that Toronto desperately needs to encounter, but in a, you know, sensationalistic and violent and angry way. But, you know, I don't know what to tell you. It's peak Toronto Life. It's them doing what they do as well as they've ever done it. Mm. And I enjoyed reading every sentence of this piece.
So are you saying that Toronto Life will be lining people up against the wall?
I just can't tell what side they're on. I know what side they're on. But, I feel like, you know, they know that they need to break out of their like Rosedale readership if they're going to survive. Mm. And they have succeeded in getting everybody to read their content for the worst possible reasons.
Yeah, I love your take. And I see myself on so many sides of this. You know, it's like, I think that's truly the sign of great art, is that you can interpret it in so many different ways, you know, like an E.E. Cummings poem or a Salvador Dali painting. This should just be framed and put in a museum. But while I definitely like your take on this, I think there's another side, which is like, Toronto Life has really kicked ass recently. I wrote a great piece on the Don Jail. And is it going to be harder for a major Toronto readership to take it seriously and read it regularly, other than one hate read, if they don't see themselves represented in it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think obviously New York Magazine is their model for how they do things. There are some things in Toronto Life that genuinely get me livid and that I don't enjoy ironically, as I maybe did this piece. Like a lot of their pieces, Michael Bryant and on Sami Yateem, like a lot of the stories are basically could be summed up into, oh, power was right after all. And it's just buttressing the elites of Toronto in a way that I find really disgusting, for them going to bat in that way for people who don't deserve it. And in the Yateem case, and I would argue the Bryant case, the facts didn't bear it out at all. They didn't need to do that.
Mm. Which is interesting when you compare it to something like New York Magazine, which definitely like enjoys the glamour, but does not tend to really jump onto the side of power in the same way.
No, that's right. It's snarky and it's mean to power, while it also is a glossy service journalism magazine that is about where to eat and in a sense celebrating wealth and power. So like New York Magazine, I think, is the aspirational magazine. Toronto Life, I don't like when it can't decide if it's worshiping power and money or like, and then here's a little social justice on the side. Anyhow, I felt that this piece, like, this should be like their lighthouse piece. Like, this is, like, go forward from this. It engages with all of the issues while giving you the house porn. And I wouldn't be surprised if that couple uses this piece to flip their fucking house.
not surprised at all.
It ends with the beautiful shots of their soaker tub and all that shit. It checks off all the boxes. So, you know, I want to give credit where it's due. That's all.
I wonder how much of this is also related. And we were just talking about other aspirational magazines like New York. I have not looked at St. Joseph Media's finances or anything like that. But generally, like, it's my understanding that aspirational advertising and aspirational brands tend to do well, which is kind of a bummer because I feel like Toronto could really use like a general interest magazine that is like in the vein of something like The Atlantic or just like taking on some of these issues. And I can't really think of another place than Toronto Life that would step up to that. So it's kind of like a trap.
Well, Canada could use a website or a publication like that. So let's put that out there.
Cool.
Kitty, that is your Canada Land Shortcuts. I had a lot of fun talking with you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jesse.
Everybody, you can email me at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read them. I respond when I can. We're on Twitter at @CanadaLand. Katie Toth, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at @Kat_Toth. That's Kat with a K.
Our website is canadalandshow.com. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand. This show is produced by Russell Gregg. If you like what we do, please support us.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.